So tonight I want to speak about this sutta I came across when I studied Anguttara Nikaya, and this is called the Ten Noble Abodes. And at first, when I saw the translation of the title, I was going, Ten Noble Abodes? I mean, I thought there were four, right? It's like, we often when we talk about the Noble Abodes, we're talking about, the Brahma Viharas are called the Noble Abodes, and this is like a totally separate list that is, I'd never seen this list before, didn't know it existed, and I was like, oh, this is, and just it comes at things from a different angle. And essentially what the Buddha is doing here in this sutta is he's saying, here's 10 different ways you can look at, 10 different ways you can think about where you want your mind to rest. Like an abode is where we rest, where we hang out. So here's places where you want to hang out mentally in a wholesome manner. That's what this list is all about. It's like it's a it isn't like some lists you see are sequential, like one leads to the next. And it's not even that. There is a little bit of that, I think. But it's more like here's 10 different things you can think about. Here's 10 different experiences you might have when you're talking about or thinking about where your mind should spend its time. So I want to read the first little bit of it here. There are, O monks, 10 noble abodes where the noble ones have abided in the past, where they abide in the at present, and where they will abide in the future. What 10? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned five factors, possesses six factors, has a single guard, has a fourfold support, has driven away the many separate truths, has given up seeking, has clarified his thoughts, has calmed down the bodily formation, and has become well liberated in mind and well liberated by wisdom. So this is quite a list. But basically this list is like Buddhist code. Like here's these things, but if you didn't know what they were, what is this whole talk I want to try and explain as best I can, what these 10 different abodes are, and explain them partly by looking at other things that are said in other suttas as well, so referring to other things. So he starts out with this one. And how has a monk abandoned five factors? Here a monk has abandoned sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt. Thus he has abandoned five factors. Well, this is a list of the five kilesas, the five things that are considered obstructions to the practice or things that veil the mind so you can't see clearly. And basically saying he's abandoned them. Abandon is always a word that the Buddha uses to say, not, they, I don't, just don't go there anymore. I've got past them. I'm not affected by them anymore. This is a formidable state of mind. Not have be affected by this is no mean feat. Okay, just want to read something. Let's see, this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is from the famous Sutta 27 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called The Simile of the Elephant's Footprints. And he's describing what it's like to. The elephant is the Buddha, and everybody else sits inside the Buddha's footprint, right? On returning from his omrounds, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with the mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with the mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. He's mindful, fully aware, purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt. Unperplexed about the wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. So this is what he's talking about when he says he's abandoned the five factors. Notice the same word, abandon, occurs. He's only now he's being a little more. It's a lot more description about things. I love what he says, abandoning sloth and torpor. He abides free from sloth and torpor, mindful and fully aware. And for doubt, he says, abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt. So this is describing one way, one abode, where we might be happy to be in mentally. This is like he's describing a mental state where we're free of having to struggle with the kleshas. Seems like something that might be worthwhile. But then he goes on, says, and how does a monk possess six factors? Here, monks, having seen a form with the eye, a monk is neither elated nor dejected, but he dwells equanimous, mindful and clearly comprehending. And so too, when he hears a sound with the ear, smells an odor with the nose, savors a taste with the tongue, contacts a tactile object with the body, or cognizes a mind object with the mind. In this way, he possesses six factors. So here, he's just shifted modes completely. Now he's talking with the traditional teaching on the six sense doors, and he's describing this state of mind where no matter what happens, you're not drawn towards what arises or repelled by it. You remain equanimous, no matter what. But no matter what arises at the sense doors, you retain your equanimity. This, once again, a pretty powerful mind state. This is something from the Samyutta Nikaya. And here, this is we're in the section in the Samyutta Nikaya called the Book of the Six Sense Bases. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the Dhamma for abandoning all. Listen to that. And what, bhikkhus, is the Dhamma for abandoning all? The eye is to be abandoned. Forms are to be abandoned. Eye consciousness is abandoned. Eye contact is to be abandoned. And whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, has to be abandoned. So here he's saying, he's being quite precise about abandoning the eye sense door, right? He's abandoning, even abandoning the Vedana that arises from that contact. Which means, by here he's talking about when we're abandoning the Vedana, it means we're not sort of reacting to the Vedana in our habitual mind patterns of, oh, that was pleasant and I want more. Oh, that was unpleasant and I want to push it away. And he goes through exactly the same wording, essentially, or the other five sense doors. So once again, this is a mind state that sounds like it's something worthwhile, right? It's like being able to maintain equanimity no matter what's presented at the sense doors is a very strongly concentrated, powerful mind state. And I guess at this point, I think at this point, really what this list is a list of, here's 10 different ways you could get a sense that you've gone a long way in the process and are heading towards enlightenment. I mean, can you imagine not being affected by the five kilesas or by the six sense doors? Not being able to maintain equanimity no matter what. This is the powerfully concentrated and still mind that he's describing here. Then he goes on, of course. How does a monk have a single guard? A monk possesses a mind guarded by mindfulness. In this way, he has a single guard. So this is basically just saying, if your mind is always mindful, if you're always in a state of mindfulness, that's a pretty good description of a high, pure state of mind. And once again, this is reflected in other places. For instance, I got to use a whole bunch of my books to do this. It was great. This is in the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's basically the last line or two. And he's talking about what it's like to be mindful of one of the particular objects. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. He abides independent. So there's that word abode again, right? He abides independent. In other words, not needing anything. And he's not clinging to anything in the world. That's a pretty interesting definition of mindfulness, of the purity of mindfulness. And so he's saying mindfulness is what guards his mind. Mindfulness is what gives his guard. So that's why they call it has a single guard. He's saying that's what protects us. Mindfulness protects us. That's what a guard does, right? Mindfulness protects us from getting distracted into other things that we maybe don't want to be distracted by. And he goes on. We're into up to number four here. And how does a monk have a fourfold support? Here, monks, a monk uses some things after reflection, endures some things after reflection, avoids some things after reflection, and dispels some things after reflection. In this way, a monk has a fourfold support. What's he getting at here? And basically, this is a really interesting sort of different way of describing right effort. You know, traditionally when we talk about right effort, we're saying that when we detect the arising of unwholesome mind state, we do what we can to dispel it. Use the word dispel there for one of these things. We do whatever we can to make sure we don't get into a situation where an unwholesome mind state arises. When it's something wholesome arises, we do what we can to keep it around, and we do whatever we can to create the causes and conditions that in a wholesome mind state will arise. This is the same four things expressed differently. So if we can, now he's saying, here's another way to look at it. Let's see if you can always have right effort. Can you always have wholesome effort? So mindfulness is one of the things he talked about in this topic, these first two. This is all about concentration, particularly the The one where it's saying equanimous matter water rises at the sensors, that's a concentration exercise. Then he talks about mindfulness, and now he's talking about right effort. Oh, look, the three steps that are part of the Eightfold Path that are so important in terms of the mental practice, the mental disciplines. And he's covered all three of these, but from a totally different sort of angle. And he doesn't say that's what he's doing. And this is this is what the Buddha does all the time. He keeps trying to find, it's what it feels like, trying to find different ways to express the same ideas. And that's what this sutta seems to be about. Ah, number five. And how, monks, has the monk driven away the separate truths? Here, monks, there are many separate truths held by diverse aesthetics and Brahmins, such as the world is eternal, or the world is not eternal, the world is finite, or the world is infinite, the soul is one thing and the body another, or the soul and the body are the same. The Tathagata exists after death. The Tathagata does not exist after death. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. Or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. A monk has discarded all of these, driven them away, renounced and rejected them, released, abandoned, and relinquished them. In this way, a monk has driven away the many separate truths. This is a strongly recurring theme in the Buddhist teachings. In his day, at that time, 2,500 years ago in North India, there were a lot of different sects of monastics who held particular beliefs, held a particular view. And this list he just gave, here's some of the classic views that would hold in these different sects. Yeah. And he's saying, basically, don't get distracted by this stuff. These things are not worth thinking about. Basically, these are like those esoteric questions that really, from our limited mental point of view, we can think about them all we want, but we'll never come up with a final answer, because they're not things that we can think about and come up with a rational answer to. There are things that are beyond our rational capability to understand. So if that's the case, why bother thinking about them? This was the point that the Buddha came back to many, many times, where he basically said, way better off not to spend time trying to figure this stuff out, these questions that are of infinite nature, essentially. And instead, just practice. And when you practice, eventually those questions will become irrelevant. It's not that you know the answer, that these won't be relevant anymore. You'll see that they're just sort of mental games that people want to play. And it's like, if I hold this view and state it so strongly and give all my logical, semi-logical, pretend logical explanations for them, I'll look really smart. And people will think I'm a great guy and a wise teacher, et cetera, which is what went on all the time in the Buddhist day. And he was saying, don't waste your time with any of this stuff. Don't go there at all. That's why he actually says, what was the actual word here that struck me? He's abandoned and relinquished. Not only have you abandoned them, you've relinquished them. Which means I don't even want to trying to hold on to them in any way. They're gone. I may have entertained them at one time, because we all do. This is like, he understands human nature, the Buddha, and he knows that these are questions like this are things that people have always contemplated, always tried to figure out. It's part of the nature of the mind. And basically, they're not worthwhile. So we need to relinquish them. We need to relinquish our desire to figure things out in this way. You know, we have to stop trying to figure things out and just press. And to actually be in a place where we don't think about those things anymore would be quite an interesting place, because now we're just dedicating ourselves to practice all the time. We're not caught in this mental whirlpool of stuff that we're always trying to figure out, which just gets in the way, basically. Then we come to number six. This one I had to think about for quite a while. Number six, and how has a monk given up seeking? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned the search for sensual pleasure and the search for becoming, and has suspended the search for a holy life. In this way, a monk has given up seeking. Well, the first one, I thought, well, that's pretty obvious. He's given up. He stopped looking for sensual pleasure. In other words, I'm no longer even trying to find anything that's pleasant. I'm not caught in the desire cycle, which most of us live in all the time. Well, I want to get this, and I want to get that, and when I get that, then I'll get this. And that's how our mind functions in our culture. And he's saying, no, he's abandoned looking for sensual pleasure at all. This doesn't say he won't experience sensual pleasure and notice it if it happens, but it's seeking it anymore. And then he says, and search for becoming. So here he's talking about, this is Buddhist code. Basically, the sense of becoming is this idea that we have a separate self. I want to, searching for becoming is searching for some way where I can clearly see that my separate self actually exists. This is pretty powerful thing to be able to say, I've given up seeking it. I mean, Buddha, on the night of his enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree, the last thing he said, the last thing he had to give up was the subtle sense of self, of a separate self. So this is like big time, you know, giving up the, stop trying to figure out how I can define myself in some way so that I can see that I'm a separate self. That's how we stop seeking becoming. Okay. But then the third one said, and has suspended the search for a holy life. And this one I went, huh? I said, what's he talking about here? I mean, how can you? But that's what we were doing. I thought that's what the practice was about. It's like trying to, you know, search for or understand somehow lead a holy life. So how could giving up seeking the holy life be important and be worthwhile? That was the question I had to answer. And then I remembered this sutta. And this is, right, it's this one. So this is from a sutta called the Simile of the Snake, which actually is a whole list of similes. And in there is this thing called the Simile of the Rat. And I think some of you probably heard me talk about this simile, because I've actually do a whole Dharma talk just a simile, because I think it's interesting. But basically, the whole story is, this person comes to great body of water and has to get across to the other side because it's not safe on this shore and it's wonderful on the other shore. So he constructs a raft to get him across to the other side. And it takes a lot of effort, and he has to try times and so on. But the thing here is, now the raft, the body of water is our mind. It's like there's this flood, something's called the flood. And this flood of stuff is going through our mind all the time. Just never stops. This is, our mind is just always being flooded by things that are arising and that we're paying attention to. And the raft is the Dhamma. The raft is Buddha's teachings. And it's the Buddha's teachings that are going to get us across to the other side. So that's the ideas behind the simile. But then this really interesting thing he says, yeah, by doing what would that man be doing? What should be done with that raft? So he's got a cross to the other side, but he still has this great raft. Now what do I do with it? You know, in an earlier part of the sutta, he talks about the guy would sort of, you know, carry it with him. And the Buddha said, no. You don't want to take that raft with you. And I was, well, I remember the first time I read this, I was like, what? You don't want the Dhamma with you? I mean, it says, here, bhikkhus, when that man got across and arrived at the far shore, he might think, this raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it into the dry land, let it to drift in the water, and then go wherever I want. In other words, just, okay, I'm done with that raft. It's achieved what I've achieved what I need to achieve by using this raft. I've got to the shore. So now I have to let it go. Now, because it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with the raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. This is subtle stuff. And it took me a while to sort of be okay with this idea in a sense. It's like even the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, if we're not careful, are just become things, something we cling to. And in the end, when we've crossed to the other shore, which is, you know, that's Buddha code for become enlightened, you don't need the raft anymore. You don't need the Dhamma anymore. The Dhamma is just a raft to get you to the other side. And if you cling to it, then you're carrying around huge weight all the time that you don't need to be carrying around anymore. You need to be able to let go of even the Buddha's teachings, that they're just something to get you to the other side, and then they've done their job. That's how, you know, we give up searching for the holy life. That's what he's talking about here. He's talking about at a certain point, we've lived the holy life. We've got us to the other side. Now we just let it go. Just let it go. That's the ideal that is laying out here. It's hard to take in. It's hard for me to understand because partly because I'm such a Dhamma junkie, right? You know, like how can I give all this stuff? But what he's saying is at some point, that's what has to happen. You have to let go even that. That nothing can be clung to. Nothing. Not even the Buddhist teachings. So it would be a big thing to be able to do, actually know that it was okay. This is the problem, of course. How do you know when it's okay to let go of the raft, right? How do you know you're not letting go of the raft, but you're only actually halfway across and you're going to sink in the middle? You know, those sort of images arise very quickly. But it's like at some point, you're on the other shore and you don't need the Dhamma anymore. The Dhamma's done its job. Then, of course, that's only number six. There's four more. And how has a monk clarified his thoughts? Here, monks, a monk has abandoned sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of violence. In this way, the monk has clarified his thoughts. And it's just that we covered this back there in numbers 1 and 2 or something like that, right? This is where I think these things are a little bit sequential. Because what he's saying here, and in another translation, it's like, instead of saying he has clarified his thoughts, he's undisturbed in his resolve, has given up sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of violence. So not, they haven't just given up action and words, but you've given up thoughts. You've these thoughts of sensual thoughts and ill will and violence just don't occur at all. Wouldn't that be an interesting mental state to be in? Wouldn't that be like a place that we all would like to be? But this reminded me of the Metta Sutta, actually, where, you know, the Buddha in the Metta Sutta has described, you know, how to be loving, full of loving kindness. Then he says you have to do this for all beings. And then he says, just to make sure we understand, there's these four lines are sort of in the middle of the sutta here. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So we don't even wish harm upon another. In other words, we've abandoned the mental state, not just the words and actions that often express ill will. We've actually abandoned the mental process itself. So that, and this is a description of someone who is full of metta all the time, who's basically is functioning in a world where metta is how they operate in the world, from a place of metta all the time. They always operate from a place of goodwill, of loving kindness. Once again, sounds good to me, right? Okay. And of course, there's still more. So here, and then the Buddha says, and how is a monk calmed the bodily formation? Here, monks, with abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and sadness, a monk enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. In this way, a monk has calmed down the bodily formation. So here, now the Buddha is talking about these deeply concentrated states called the jhanas. And the fourth jhana is sort of usually the end of the jhanas. And what he's describing here is this, in the fourth jhana, your sense of a separate body starts to just dissolve. And the mind is so concentrated and so precise that though you're still noting things as they arise, there's no process of combining those things that you're experiencing together to turn them all together into a body somehow. You're simply just concentrated on what's actually arising right now in the moment, and that's all that's ever going on in your mind. This is a state of very deep concentration. Excuse me. So the sense of a separate body, of a separate self, which starts by getting rid of a sense of a separate body, has arisen. And the mind is so precisely concentrated that mindfulness is just there all the time. concentration and mindfulness have joined together in this deeply concentrated state. So we're just seeing what's arising. Once again, these are like descriptions of what it means to be enlightened, obviously, right? And he goes on. And how is a monk well liberated in mind? Here, a monk's mind is liberated from lust, hatred, and delusion. This way, a monk is well liberated in mind. Well, lust, hatred, and delusion, the three points. So it's like the constant theme that says these are the things we have to overcome. Anything that one of these abodes is of an abode where the mind is liberated. In other words, never experiences, is liberated from lust, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons. In this way, a monk is well liberated in mind. And then the last in this list is well released, liberated, liberated internment. And how is a monk well liberated by wisdom? Here, a monk understands, lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned by me, cut off at the root, made barren like palm tree stumps, obliterated so that they are no longer subject to arise in the future. In this way, a monk is well liberated by wisdom. So this is saying at a certain point in this process, you actually understand that you are liberated, that you know. And the sutras are full of people who describe this, like, that they've cut everything, these words are quite similar. There's also books of poems by nuns who were practicing at the Buddha's time in his Sangha, and they all wrote poems about what it was like to be liberated. Like, it's somehow you know. Don't ask me how. But that's what what's saying is, like, you know that your mind is liberated. That you've just cut off everything else at the root, and you're free, you're liberated. So this is, once again, talking about what it means to be enlightened. And so all 10 of these are really coming at the description of what it's like to have this pure mind from different angles. So it's almost like one of these 10 would be fine. Any one of these 10, if we got out in one of these 10, would be doing great. It'd be wonderful. There is some that's at the beginning, about being liberated from the kalas and being liberated from what's arising at the sense doors are more beginner enlightenment, if you can think of it sense. And these last couple are like, okay, now we're enlightened. Like, we're done. Thank you very much. It's very clear. It's so clear I know. I can see that liberation has arisen. But then the Buddha goes on. He doesn't stop here. This is, I think this is quite interesting. Whatever noble ones in the past, O monks, abided in noble abodes, all abided in these 10 noble abodes. Whatever noble ones in the future will abide in noble abodes, all will abide in just these 10 noble abodes. Whatever noble ones at present abide in noble abodes, all abide in just these 10 noble abodes. These monks are the 10 noble abodes in which the noble ones abided in the past, abide in the present, and will abide in the future. So why add this? What is this? Why is this addendum, in a sense, almost? Basically, what he's saying is, Doesn't matter if how it was in the past or how it's going to be in the future. These 10 things, these 10 descriptions of purified mind won't change. These definitions are not subject to change in the sense that this is the how the mind is and how the mind can become, and minds are minds, and they're not going to change. They're not different now than they were in the past. They're not different now than they are 2 minutes ago, and they're not going to be different in the future. This is how the mind works. And so these abodes, which are descriptions of mental states, won't change. Don't change. They are what the practice is all about, is heading towards, working towards these purified mental states. And I want to make sure you understand that the problem is if we're not careful, we start going, oh, I'm nowhere near any of those things. But that's okay. We're all moving towards them. That this is what this practice is about. This practice is about heading in that direction. It's the process leads towards these things. And we start to have little moments of these things, and we start to have larger moments of these things. And then we go, ah, okay, I see. You start to get a sense for what these 10 mean. Somehow we get a little flavor of them, a little taste of them in our practice. And over time, those tastes become more frequent and more solid over time until this is one of these abodes are where we live. Where we're heading towards this great town with these 10 abodes, and one day we're going to live in them. But right now we're just working towards them. We're in this process, and that's what's important. It's the process that's important. Don't What I'm saying is, don't get hung up on like, oh, I have to be like that. You have to move towards that. This is why we're still on that raft in the middle of this flood, flopping around with our arms and legs trying to get across. That's what we're doing. And so we have to understand that these are descriptions of ideal mind states that are experienced and have been experienced and will be experienced in the future by countless beings. It's not like some impossible fantasy world. It's just like this is where we're headed towards. I'm working on this. This is why we continue to practice. Little bit of poetry just to finish off here. And this is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And this particular poem is called Logos. This is different than a lot of the poems I read, but I came across it when I was looking at things for this talk. Why wonder about the loaves and fishes? If you say the right words, the wine expands. If you say them with love, and you feel and the felt ferocity of that love, and the felt necessity of that love, the fish explode into many. Imagine him speaking, and don't worry about what is reality, or what is plain, or what is mysterious. If we were there, it was all those things. If you can imagine it, it is all those things. Eat, drink, be happy. Accept the miracle. Accept too each spoken word spoken with love. Can we do that? Can we accept each spoken word spoken with love and really take that in? That seems to me another abode I want to hang out in.